You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You might expect a filmmaker to work on a documentary for a couple of years, maybe five tops. But Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky have spent 18 years returning to the same topic, a case involving three teenagers who were convicted of the brutal rape, mutilation, and deaths of three young boys in rural Arkansas. The first film, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, came out in 1996 and won both Emmy and Peabody Awards. They followed that with Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, in 2000. And now there's the final film in the series, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, which will be shown on Monday at 6 o'clock as part of the New York Film Festival, and then in January on HBO. I'm very pleased that Joe Berlinger could come back to our show to talk about it. Hi.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Now, you've worked on other documentaries over the years. We had you here for Crude more recently, and you were here for your first film, Brother's Keeper, back in 1992, which was about an elderly man who was charged with second-degree murder after the death of his brother. What led you to this particular story?
That's a good question. I just want to mention, too, you know, Bruce Sanofsky was supposed to be here today, but he's not feeling well, so, you know, I'm sorry he's not here.
It's going around.
It is going around. You know, Sheila Nevins, you know, the great documentary leader over at HBO, sent us a newspaper clipping back in the days when people actually sent newspaper clippings, you know, by messenger. We opened up this envelope and there was a newspaper clipping of a little story in the New York Times, which we didn't realize was at the time was just an AP wire pickup of a local news story. And we didn't realize at the time just how one-sided the local press was, but this was a little local story in coming out of the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, Tennessee, which is 8 miles from West Memphis, Arkansas, where this crime took place. And basically, the story seemed like a very open and shut case of three heavy metal-loving, black T-shirt-wearing teen killers, teen Satanists, who had taken these 3 8-year-old boys into the woods and allegedly sacrificed them to the devil. And what's been fascinating for us about this multi-film, two-decade journey is that our original mission, you know, we discussed it with Sheila and thought there might be a film. We thought we were going down to make a film about guilty teenagers, about kids gone awry.
Satanism and heavy metal and all of that were a big topic at the time.
Exactly. You know, people may or may not remember the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, there was kind of this satanic hysteria wave gripping the country, and the media was fanning the flames, and many unexplained crimes were written off or ascribed to these underground devil worshipping cults. The FBI later, you know, not too much later after this case, you know, determined that there's no connection between any of these unsolved crimes and devil worshipping. But at the time, we thought we were going to make a film about bad guys.
Well, it was a small piece in the Times, but was this a big story in Arkansas at the
time? Huge. It was one of the, you know, this was the most vicious crime to have gripped the state in its history. This was, you know, we went down there and there were just every local news outlet was there. People were terrified. And we thought we were making a film about one thing. And you know, we started digging into the evidence, and 1 + 1 was not equaling 2. And it took a few months for us to get access, actually, to the West Memphis 3. We had to negotiate access. And I think one of the keys to the original Paradise Lost film was the fact that we actually got down there right upon the arrests and were embedded with that community and filming a good 7 months before the trials even began. And so it took us a few months to get access to the West Memphis 3. But after Bruce and I did our first interviews with Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly, we just were convinced that they were not guilty.
And in retrospect, it's heartbreaking in this film when you cut back and forth between the first documentary and we see a 16-year-old Jason Baldwin telling you how he was looking forward to being back with his parents once this whole thing was over. Later, you ask Damien Echols what was going through his mind during the trial, and He looks unperturbed because he felt he was innocent and there was no reason to be upset.
Yeah, I mean, Damien is a fascinating character, and Damien's whole demeanor is actually what has attracted a tremendous amount of celebrity and grassroots support because people saw in them, you know, Johnny Depp said, hey, I'm from rural Kentucky. I dress differently. I listen to different kind of music. And that could have been me under the right circumstances. So on the one hand, Damien's persona is what attracted all of this support, which has come to a head in recent months. And we can talk about that in a minute, you know, what the ultimate result is. But at the time, Damien was not his own best advocate. He was a somewhat narcissistic. He was an alienated kid. He was goth before that label was applied. And he was a little scary to the...
Had a strange haircut.
Yeah, I mean, look, if he was...
Especially for rural Arkansas.
As Bruce and I have often said, if Damien Echols was living in New York or L.A., he'd be one of tens of thousands of, you know, heavy metal listening kids. But in rural West Memphis, Arkansas, he kind of stood out. And he was not, you know, when they put him on the stand, you know, he seemed to be enjoying the negative attention, and that did not help him.
So the first film suggested that these kids were innocent, even though they had been found guilty. That would have been the end for most people. Why did you keep on returning to the case over what would ultimately be 18 years?
Well, you know, the film took a long time to edit. These guys were locked away in March of 94, they were locked away. It took us 2 years to edit the film, and it didn't come out until 96. And like Errol Morris's Thin Blue Line, we thought this film was going to just blow the doors open of this case. And we were just extremely disappointed, even though the film got Emmys and Peabody's and people were patting us on the backs. And the film did everything a film could do, Sundance, HBO, all that stuff, but it never migrated off of the entertainment pages into the news pages. And, you know, I would brush my teeth in the morning and think, oh, my God, these guys are still in prison. You know, I'd go to work. These guys are still in prison. We were just haunted by it. We just felt like something had to be done.
Well, you convinced a lot of people, and it actually led to a movement and people contributing a lot of money to the defense fund for these kids. But why do you think it didn't have any impact on the justice system?
You know, the state of Arkansas just dug in, and I think one of the most important lessons we can learn from this series of films is that the death penalty is just, forget the issue of taking a life, just on a human fallibility standpoint. The justice system is run by human beings who dig into a position and refuse to budge. And from that standpoint, you can never have a death penalty because we just see how easy it is for flaws to happen. I mean,
So was Damien Echols under threat of being executed for all those 18 years?
He was. But luckily, you know, he has said that if it wasn't for the films, he would have been executed already because he had run out of his appeals. And it's difficult to explain, but in 2001, Arkansas passed a DNA statute, which opened the door to a new investigation. And if there wasn't a well-funded effort to pursue that DNA investigation, his appeals would have run out and he would have been executed.
So how did the three of them handle their incarceration over the years?
We're still trying to figure that out and just to see what kind of impact they have. But I am amazed at how they retained their dignity and their sanity. I mean, Damien Echols was on death row for 18 years, the last 10 of which he literally had no sunshine upon his body. He has arthritis, his eyesight, because he was in a confined space where he could not see long, far distances, and therefore you lose the ability to focus far away when you don't have that opportunity. So his eyesight is failing, and yet he became an ordained Buddhist monk.
He got married.
I mean, one of the great stories of the Paradise Lost series is that the second screening, you know, the film premiered at Sundance in January of 96, and then in March of 96, the next stop for this film was the new director's new film series at Lincoln Center with a screening at the Museum of Modern Art. And a Brooklyn-based architect who is just living a normal life and, in fact, was dragged to the movie, she told us later, because she read the logline and just didn't want to go down that road of this horrible story. But she ended up going to the movie, became just obsessed with the case, and woke up the next day feeling these guys were innocent, reached out to Damien via mail. They exchanged letters. She went down to visit him a year later, then moved to Little Rock, married the guy, and has been, this woman, Lori Davis, has been a tireless advocate for his defense ever since, and has been a key reason why these guys have gotten out.
They seem to have grown up, obviously. 18 years, they were teenagers when they went in. Jason Baldwin points out at one point that he had already spent 60% of his life in prison.
Yeah, no, it just boggles my mind how much time these guys spent in prison.
But did you see changes over the years? They grew up. They seem to be less bitter than one might have expected.
Yeah, no, these guys have grown up to be incredibly special people. You know, I don't know if I could have hacked it for 18 years under any circumstances, let alone not be bitter. I mean, one of the great things that happened, you know, this weekend, my wife and I took Jason Baldwin to Sting's 60th birthday party at the Beacon Theater. It was a big celebration with Bruce Springsteen, Lady Gaga. And I'm sitting near these guys, and I just thinking to myself, my God, this guy was like in the Slammer 6 weeks ago, and now he's sitting here at the Beacon listening to this rock and roll show. And this was literally his first rock and roll experience, because he was plucked as a 16-year-old from an impoverished trailer park and put in prison for 18 years.
He also wouldn't have known who Lady Gaga was, except if he was allowed to read newspapers. He wouldn't have known what an iPhone was.
Exactly.
He probably hadn't done very much with a computer.
Exactly. I mean, one of the amazing little anecdotes, too, is, you know, on August 19th, as some people know, these guys were released from prison. And that evening, there was a rooftop party at a hotel in Memphis that Eddie Vedder and Natalie Maines threw
of
the Dixie Chicks, two very impassioned supporters of the West Memphis Three. And just looking, you know, Damien was given a new iPhone, and, you know, just looking at these guys free up on a rooftop in Memphis, Tennessee, as the sun was setting, you know, and these guys are looking at their iPhones and having a drink, you know, it just was indescribable.
Well, they do seem like unlikely friends. Damien Echols was the leader. He was older than the others. Jason Baldwin's a bright young kid, but barely formed. And then Jesse Miskelly, the third member of the group, is mentally challenged.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it. They said that he had the mind of a 5-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, look, Echols and Baldwin were friends, and I can understand that friendship, and they shared a love of music, in particular Metallica, and that's one of the things that was used against them at the trial. I mean, Metallica lyrics were actually introduced to the trial as evidence of devil worshiping, which is absurd on so many levels, not the least of which is Metallica lyrics have nothing to do with devil worshiping. They're anti-authoritarian, but they're certainly not devil worshiping. But they will tell you that they were not really, they knew of Miskelly, but they weren't friends with him. I mean, this was a concoction by the police, you know, the fact that these guys were an alleged devil worshiping cult.
Well, you get the feeling that they were already concerned about possible Satanism in the community. And so when this case came along, that became their focus before they had much reason to even consider any alternative, and there could have been many alternatives. You proposed a few.
Absolutely. I mean, there was a Damien Echols tunnel vision in that community. I mean, one of the discoveries we made in this new film is that we went to go re-interview the alleged satanic, not the alleged, he was the satanic expert, quote unquote, at the trial. His credentials are alleged because
there's a man who got a degree
from a mail order Millhouse. Yeah. And so we went to re-interview him in 2010, and he pulls out this fax, which we had never seen or heard about before. He pulls out a fax of Damien Echols' writings and drawings that a juvenile officer of Crittenden County had faxed to him a year before the murders, because they were concerned about these writings and drawings. And, you know, some of these writings were, you know, quotes from Shakespeare, Metallica lyrics, you know, Stephen King. I mean, it's crazy. These guys were gunning for this satanic motive even before this crime happened.
My guest is Joe Berlinger, who is co-director and producer with Bruce Sanofsky of Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, which is going to be shown on the Monday the 10th, that's next Monday, at 6 p.m. at Alice Tully Hall as part of the New York Film Festival. And then it's going to be shown as part of the Hamptons Film Festival.
Yeah, it'll be at the Hamptons Festival the weekend of the 14th and 15th, and then at the Jacob Burns on the November 3rd it'll be playing.
And then in January it'll be on HBO. And for more information about tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Joe Berlinger, who, with Bruce Sanofsky, written and directed and produced three films called Paradise Lost, the latest Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, which is going to be shown at the New York Film Festival this coming Monday at 6 p.m. The film was completed before the latest part of the story was told.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, Bruce and I have been working on this film since 2004, and we didn't know when to end it. However, the Arkansas Supreme Court last year finally made a decision in Echols' favor and granted an evidentiary hearing to allow DNA and other new evidence to be presented, which the circuit court had previously denied. And that evidentiary hearing was supposed to be in December, and so we felt it was and HBO felt it was a good time to get that film done and out and on television in November, which we've now moved it because of this, what's gone down. But we were originally going to air this film in November to just shine a light on this evidentiary hearing and make sure it goes well as it can be. And so we were literally around August 15th in the mixing room of, you know, with a finished product, getting it ready because it had been accepted to the Toronto Film Festival, and we were getting ready to finish the film when we get a call letting us know that something big is happening that week. I mean, legally they weren't allowed to tell us specifically what was happening, but it was intimated that it's as big as it gets. So we dropped everything and ran down to Arkansas to witness, you know, this historic moment.
Although it's a very odd ending, and we'll get to that in a little while. But I was thinking about this in the light of the justice system. You mentioned that Arkansas just dug in its heels. They appealed many times. And were denied because the same judge who had convicted them heard all of the appeals? Did he just not...
I guess it's legal in Arkansas and other states, but it has always boggled my mind that the presiding judge over the original trials was also the judge throughout this entire 18-year odyssey, and only because he ran for state senator and won very recently did he retire from the case and was no longer able to rule on it. But
it makes you wonder what's going on in the state senate when you look at this judge who is just so rigid in his thinking.
Well, I mean, also just the I'm just, you know, I'm not a legal scholar, but I can't understand how the same judge would be allowed to pass judgment over whether or not the original trial was a fair trial, as if he's ever going to recuse himself.
Well, you've had your own experience on another film with the American justice system. So you must be very frustrated.
Well,
that was an odd case. You made a film called Crude, and you revealed that some oil companies had despoiled a major part of the Amazon. It's quite clear. And you wound up being sued by the oil company?
Yeah, I was sued by Chevron last year in a very big First Amendment battle. They weren't actually suing me for defamation or the typical lawsuit. They were suing me to get access to all of my dailies and all of my emails. And that was a bitter, long, expensive battle. You know, my movie...
Well, why not just give it to them?
Well, because...
The film is still the same film, isn't it?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. Most notably, you can't open the door to allowing corporations or any litigant access to a reporter's notes. You know, my footage are like my reporter's notes, and it would have an incredible chilling effect on getting people to be whistleblowers or to talk about any subject if they know that every word of theirs, some of which is said in confidence, would be just turned over.
So you lost the case.
I did. I lost in a big way. The movie cost $1.2 million, and the lawsuit cost $1.3 million. You know, on a film that did terribly at the box office. So it was a very painful experience. A lot of people helped pay those bills, but it still cost me personally a significant amount of time, money, and concern, because it was an ugly battle. And, you know, I think the lesson of both my Crude experience and observing what's gone down for two decades with the West Memphis 3 case is, you know, I don't want to categorically criticize the American justice system. Sometimes it works, but sometimes it can devolve into a place where, you know, it's not about a search for the truth, but it's, you know, who's got the most money to tell their story. And that is deeply disturbing, because there was such antipathy in the West Memphis case for uncovering the truth.
You show the chief investigator, Gary Gitchell, over the years, and he says in one of the more recent interviews that there was far more information than you had in the documentary that proved that these kids were guilty. Did you ever find out what he meant?
Well, as the woman who the lawyer who's deposing him, because that's a deposition tape, says, you know, but is there other evidence that hasn't been uncovered? And he then goes on to admit there isn't, you know. So
on the other hand, people making the case for the West Memphis 3 say there is new evidence. Was that really new evidence, or was it just a matter of evaluating the evidence that had been there all along in a different way from the way the police had approached it?
It's a little of both. I mean, there was definitely new DNA evidence that definitely excluded the West Memphis 3. That was new and quite compelling. But a lot of the evidence, or new evidence, was just reevaluating old information. The most notably, Dr. Werner Spitz, who's one of the leading forensic pathologists, you know, discovered that the theory of how the kids were killed was completely incorrect. These wounds that were allegedly stabbing wounds with a knife that was part of this satanic ritual actually turned out to be wounds caused by animals post-mortem, that this was post-mortem animal predation. And so obviously these
animals
kids
just scratching the kids,
the dead
to
bodies.
Get their bodies.
So, right. So obviously these kids were killed by a human being, and obviously they were beaten to death. But the wound patterns that were used at trial to demonstrate that this was a satanic ritual actually were caused after death by animals.
One of the arguments made for reopening the case was that in the original trial, they were only allowed to consider evidence that proved these kids guilty, not any other evidence.
Well, that was what the whole Arkansas. It wasn't really in the original trial. What the Arkansas Supreme Court finally agreed with Echols' attorneys was that during the appeals process, when this DNA evidence was uncovered, the state took the position that the DNA statute says you can consider DNA evidence and only all other evidence of guilt in determining whether they need a new trial, which is kind of nonsensical. The statute actually says, in everyone's belief, and the Arkansas Supreme Court affirmed this, that any evidence over the last 17 years in addition to the new evidence should be considered. And the fact that the state of Arkansas was trying to limit new evidence from being considered by the district court just demonstrates a lack of desire for transparency, a lack of desire for determining what really happened.
My guest is Joe Berlinger, who's co-director and producer of Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory with Bruce Sanofsky, his partner. The film will be screened at the New York Film Festival this coming Monday at 6 p.m. at Alice Tully Hall. And for information about that and some other screenings, you can check out our website at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. In the first film, Damien suggests that one of the stepfathers of one of the victims, a stepfather of one of the victims, might have been the murderer. And, of course, he was outraged. And he became one of the most vocal accusers of the West Memphis 3, but then later he changed his mind.
Yeah, no, it's the journey, the cinematic and real life journey of John Mark Byers is truly one of the fascinating aspects of these films. You know, he at first believed wholeheartedly in their guilt,
he looked guilty to a lot of the people who saw the first film.
He did, you know, and a lot of people I think confused the fact that, you know, we were covering suspicion as opposed to creating suspicion. You know, some people have accused Paradise Lost of pointing a finger at Byers. I would argue that we were covering the suspicion that was directed towards him. You know, but he was definitely a fascinating character who took this amazing turn where he now believes, as does, you know, two of the three families of victims have come to believe that the West Memphis Three are innocent and support the fact that they are out of prison.
But the third one does not.
The Moore family still is firmly in the camp of that they're guilty. And look, I don't want to criticize. I can't imagine the pain of losing a child. And I think their healing process has been part of the healing process is having somebody to blame the crime on and moving on. So this, you know, I can't imagine going through it. And but they still believe in the guilt.
And they're not angry with the way the case was investigated.
They're angry with they're angry with us and angry with the support movement. They believe that the case was handled properly.
So you got a call that something was up.
Yeah.
And you went, a new judge was covering the case because the other one, as you say, was elected to the state legislature. David Laser then worked out some...
Judge Burnett was, David Burnett was the state senator now, and the new judge is David Laser.
And he worked out, or was it he who worked out this deal, which strikes almost everyone who sees the film as totally unfair?
Laser oversaw it, and I think Judge David Laser is a good guy who went out of his way during the hearing to explain what the Alford plea is. This was a deal that was quickly negotiated by the state. You know, it took years and years and years for anything to happen on this case. The whole DNA exercise took 5 or 6 years, and yet in less than 2 weeks, when the fear of this evidentiary hearing was happening and the fear of an HBO movie coming out, within 2 weeks, they negotiated this plea arrangement, this Alford plea arrangement, which is bittersweet.
Who is Alford?
There was a famous case called North Carolina versus Alford, where it made legal sense for the guy to plead guilty for legal purposes but to still maintain his innocence. And this has become a rarely deployed but important legal maneuver. And what the Alford plea is that for legal purposes, you declare, you plead guilty to lesser charges, basically. So capital murder was reduced to first-degree murder, and these guys pled guilty while still professing and maintaining their innocence. And the reason you do that is that then the judge says, okay, you've pled guilty to lesser charges, you've served 18 years in prison, we sentence you to time served, and you are released from prison.
But wasn't a new evidence hearing going to happen 4 months later that might have led or was likely to lead to a new trial, and that probably would have led to a not guilty verdict?
We all believe that that's what was going to happen, but you have a state of Arkansas that has dragged this thing out for 18 years. The evidentiary hearing was scheduled for December, but it could have been postponed, as many hearings have been. The new trial could have taken years to unfold. And so you're asking people, do you want to get out of prison now and try to prove your innocence and get exonerated out of prison? Or do you want to stay in prison for another 4 or 5, 6 years and trust a system that has so failed you miserably already? So no one blames the West. And Eccles was on death row, you know, So no one blames them. We all fully understand why they took the deal. I would have taken the deal. I don't think I could have survived on death row for 18 years. But it's just such a bittersweet and disappointing ending in terms of the state of Arkansas not just stepping up, having the courage to admit they made a mistake. Because really, by pleading guilty, that removes the possibility of a lawsuit against the state of Arkansas for wrongful conviction. And I think that was one of their biggest motivations. So these guys have had their entire young adult life taken away from them. They're now back out on the streets. And the state of Arkansas isn't giving them a penny of compensation and no prosecutorial accountability for the many things in this case that went awry. And
they also don't have to go look for who really did commit the murders.
That's the worst thing. The real killer or killers walk free. And if I was a parent of a victim, and I believe that the West Memphis Three were innocent, my state is telling me, hey, we're not going to go look for the real killers. And I think that is just devastating.
So how are these kids? Well, they're not kids anymore. They're in their 30s. How are they doing?
I think they're doing fine. I think Damien is having the hardest time just physically adjusting. You know, it's just a big difference. He spent most of his life, the last 18 years, literally in shackles with very little exercise.
Now, you got to see him a number of times. Were the prison authorities cooperative?
They were cooperative with us. I have to give them credit. We got in there whenever we wanted to. I mean, Damien tells us that, you know, on those media visit days, he would be given a fresh set of clothes and he would be allowed to wash up, and that how he looked when we were interviewing him was not how he was looked or treated most of the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the prison, I will give them credit that, and a lot of people in the prison system believe that these guys are innocent. And I think that's, you know, Jason Baldwin told us just a heartbreaking story when he first got to prison. You know, they beat him up. They you know, other prisoners, because, you know, there's nothing worse on the pecking order in prison than a child molester, child killer. And so he was kicked and beaten and his skull cracked and his collarbone broken. And that treatment went on for several years. And I asked him, well, when did it stop? And he said, well, as soon as Paradise Lost came out in 96, which was 3 years into his prison term, people went from kicking him and calling him child killer to like, hey, man, you got a raw deal and, you know, we'll watch out for you.
Are you finally finished with this story?
Well, Sheila Nevins and we have discussed doing a Paradise Lost for, you know, emotionally speaking, I feel like it's the end of an era. I was like 29 years old or 30 when I started this journey. I'm almost 50. It's been a part of the fabric of my family and my career for so long that I kind of feel like it's time to move on. On the other hand, if there's an opportunity to, you know, find out who really did this crime and we can make a compelling film out of it, you know, I certainly don't want to shut the door on that possibility.
Yeah, there are some hints in the film, although I don't want to go into that because that is the next story. Thank you so much for being with us
today. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky spent 18 years returning to this same topic, and the third film in the series, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, is going to be screened at the New York Film Festival at Ellis Tully Hall this coming Monday at 6 p.m., and then at other places. You can get all of the details by going to our website at wnyc.org. Go to our show page. And remember, it will be broadcast on HBO in January of next year. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks for having me.